All right, this is the Nightcast. This is a time where we just look a little bit further behind the curtain of Province Academy and see, you know, the inner workings. We show our heart on this show. We get to show what we think about things, and it's an unvarnished, unpolished view of just our heart. And so today we've got someone that came to the school and did some teacher training and did some parent training last year. And as he was leaving, I was like, hey, would you ever jump on the cast sometime? And he was very generous with his time. He's the author of many books and leads a counseling program for children. I don't want to butcher what you do because it's very specific and really beautiful. So I'll go ahead and introduce our guest, Dave Thomas. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, first, I want to say I'm so grateful for that intersection. I still think back on that time and how much I love being with your community. And it was just a rich experience, both the parents and the faculty. I was so thankful for that time and grateful for the work you do. Thankful we're getting to continue in conversation today. But to your kind question, I am currently the executive director of Daystar Counseling Ministries in Nashville, and we are a counseling practice that serves just the pediatric population. So our whole focus is kids, adolescents, and families. And we do the work a little different in that we're in a house rather than an office, which was a very intentional decision. We have five therapy dogs on staff who are hands down the most sought after therapists in our practice. It's very humbling to fall way in line below dogs. And I have long said, speaking of the dogs, if you get to go to work every day and work with kids and dogs, you have an amazing day job. And I'm thankful that out of that job, I get the opportunity to, at different points, travel around and connect with amazing folks like yourself and talk about different aspects of parenting and understanding development, and have, as you kindly said, written a few books, and then co-host a podcast with my dear friend and colleague Sissy Goff called Raising Boys and Girls Podcast. So I love this tool. I love this medium where we can have more thoughtful conversations. I'm grateful for social media and that we can push out some quick information to parents. It's not my favorite. I'd prefer this platform where we can have long-form, thoughtful conversations about important topics. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on, because I'm a head of school, but I'm also a parent. And kind of working through, what does it look like to minister to our children, to help raise them well? And you don't get a guidebook when your kid's born. And you don't, I don't want to mess them up. You know what I mean? You're going to mess your kids up, and that's just part of it. And there's grace and God's sovereignty in that. But understanding what's going on in your kid can be one of the most challenging things, but also doing the work to find out can be one of the most rewarding things. So can you give us this, like, kind of your, the elevator speech of what's your philosophy on raising children?
Great question. You know, I would first say to that question that I think I've long believed that we are growing alongside our kids. So it's not a one-sided equation. And I believe that the context of parenting is not the only, but one of the most extraordinary contexts for our own sanctification, our own being made more into the image of Christ, because it is, as you described, this context, something we care so deeply about. I'm fine to fumble the ball in a lot of other areas of life, but this is an arena that I want to do well. I want to be intentional. I want to be purposeful. And so it's ripe with opportunity for failure, opportunity for growth, opportunity for so many things. And I would say we can tend to lose sight of that, and our attention turns so strongly in the direction of our kids' growth and development. And I believe it is a beautiful context for our own.
That's a great word, you know, parenting and thinking about the things that you go through and the struggles and challenges. It brings about some really deep stuff. I have an executive coach, and that's just a word that they use for a counselor, for people like me that will actually go to them. And as I've been working with him the last couple of years, some of the best work we've done is I get stuck somewhere with how I parent my child. And I'm like, why am I messing this up? And why do I fall into this trap? Why do I have this tendency that I we call it my lizard brain kicks in, and I'm like, why am I doing this over and over again? And uncovering, okay, that's probably, maybe that's a good thing and that's fine, keep doing it. Or maybe like, hey, that's, you're doing that because of this, and here's a great way to acknowledge that and then grow. And then it pushes you to grow to be a better person because you want to be the best parent for your kid that you can possibly be.
Yes. I think we lose sight of the fact that, you know, we talk a lot about the second definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. And I think we can easily fall into that in the arena of parenting. And we're getting frustrated over the exact same things in the exact same ways. And our kids are stuck in certain patterns that aren't fruitful or productive for any of us. And what does it look like to bring a resilient mindset to parenting and saying, okay, if I'm doing the same thing over and over, and I'm not getting results, I want to be open to trying something different. And sometimes that needs to start with us when we have a lot of expectation around our kids doing something different. And where am I leading into being open to trying something different?
Yeah, no, that's a great word. We're getting ready to launch a project here at Providence. And it's got a bunch of different phases, but one of those projects is called the Strong Child Project. And we want to partner with parents, and that's one of the big steps of Providence. That's the first line of our mission statement, to help them to have strong children for the Lord. Looking at that definition of strong is such an interesting concept because the instant like thought mind is this like Navy SEALs, and they're just going to be like super tough. And it's like, I don't think that that's really what strong and resilient. I mean, don't get me wrong, the Navy SEALs are great. God bless America. We are so thankful for our troops. But I think that when what we're looking for is deeper, and probably Navy SEALs would tell you, hey, my strength is much deeper than what you think about just like doing some hard things and being done with it. So talk to us about, you wrote a book called Raising Emotionally Strong Boys, and I just loved that title is catching. So tell me a little bit about your thoughts on that.
I love the way you are wrestling down that word, because I think you're right. And I think at first glance, probably a lot of folks could interpret even the title of my book fitting within that classic age-old statement of man up, which quite honestly, I don't love that statement. I don't love how we, I think, misinterpret that statement. And I think we often misinterpret that to be stop having feelings, stop crying, stop fill in the blank with a lot of different things that I don't think are moving boys toward males in general, toward building what I call emotional strength, which is really, if I were going to give the Cliff Notes version of it, I think it is the ability to name and navigate our experience. And I think that's emotional strength. You know, do I recognize what I'm feeling? And then do I know how to work my way through that? That's emotional strength. And as easy and as simple as that sounds, I think this world is full of adults who never developed in those directions, or who maybe only got one half of that equation. So it's like, I can name what I am feeling. I feel angry, but I have no clue what to do with it.
Right.
Or I'm demonstrating a lot of anger, but I can't name what may be underneath that. Anger is a secondary emotion. So there's always something underneath. So, you know, can I connect with and name a fear that might be underneath that anger? And so, although it sounds simple and user-friendly, I think the world is full of adults who've never developed the emotional strength to be able to do those two things.
It's incredible figuring those things out and saying, yes, like, okay, like I've got this really strange fear is usually where it comes from. I found even with myself, and it's usually not rational. And then sometimes it makes me really great at what I do and allows me to push through certain things. And then sometimes it's the biggest limiter in my life. And so being able to notice, and then being honest with your spouse and your kids when you're like, hey, sometimes I step into this and I call it click. And when I realize like, oh, I'm using something that my emotion here, my fear here is driving me to make actions that aren't helpful to this situation. I just go click, like click that off real quick, because that's not helping anybody. But teaching kids to say like, hey, you've got to have the ability to notice that, but then the ability to navigate it. I think that that's sometimes where it's left off. It's like I struggled a long time with like doing counseling at all, because it felt like, well, let's just roll around in our emotions. And I was like, you're not going to get anything done just rolling around in your emotions. But I think you hit the nail on the head as saying like, okay, you've got the emotion, and teaching a kid to notice they have it, but let's navigate it.
Yes.
And that's where the real challenge and work is. So talk about how that might be unique with boys and might be unique with girls, and kind of what those differences, I mean, they're not universally relevant, but tell us some of those differences that you see and how parents can help with that.
I'd love to. I want to say this first, though. When I was listening to you talk about this initiative that the school is partnering with parents in, first and foremost, I want to say I love that, because you're seeing it as a partnership. Like, how can we come alongside each other in this? How can we support what parents are doing at home? How can we, who have access to these kids 35 hours a week, be a part of the great work that we're all committed to? And I love it, secondly, because I think a lot about that age-old quote from Frederick Douglass that says, it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. Mm. And I think, to me, that initiative is so aligned with the wisdom of those words. Like, how can we be doing this on the front side of development? Because both of us know, even I loved your transparency a few minutes ago. I think so many adult males in this world are somewhere between hesitant about the idea of counseling and resistant to, whether it be counseling or coaching, just getting input. When I was doing the research for the book, and this is a great lead in into the differences, I came across this research. It was fascinating. It was some statistics around the number of women who annually go for their well visit with their doctor versus men who don't. And what I think is important about starting there is this, you know, it's that sense of, we don't tend to, as males, attend to our health, our physical health, as often. Now, I would jump straight over to, I don't think we attend to our mental health generally as well as women do, our spiritual health. Like, we run straight down the threads of development, and all of that being a part of why I think adult males in this world lead the stats in some of the scariest places. Adult men lead the stats around infidelity, internet pornography, substance abuse, suicide, some of the scariest categories. The common denominator in all four of those being a male's attempt to numb out or shut down whatever it is that he's feeling.
You know what jumped me is not necessarily those scariest things, because I was like, I'm not going to kill myself or get addicted to pornography or start doing drugs or drink my... What I saw, the indicators that scared me, that I was like, I got to do something, is that these really incredible leaders, apex leaders, at the end of their careers would look up and their family would be just like in shambles, and their health would be in shambles, and their faith was in shambles. And they just looked around at age 60 or 70 and were like, what did I give my life to? Yes. And I was like, I'm not better than those men. They're incredible men that went before me. And I was just like, I can't end up in whatever that is. Like, I can't do that to myself. And not even to myself. I can't do that to my family. I can't do that to my faith, to my children, and then honestly, in the end, it ends up hurting the community or whatever you've invested in. It crumbles at the end too. And so it wasn't necessarily the scariest statistics that bothered me. It was the ones that don't necessarily end up in a stat book. Those are the ones that scared me the most.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly with you. And you know, another one that doesn't end up in the stat book, to the great point that you're making, is, okay, the current stats, for example, around anxiety are this. One in four kids, one in three adolescents, one in three adults. Girls are twice as likely to struggle. And the same is true for adult females. Now, I believe that to be 100% true. What I would add to that is, I'm convinced the statistics we have access to around males and anxiety and depression are not accurate, in that the very idea we're talking around, so many men won't seek help. I think this world is full of adult males who are struggling with anxiety and depression, but going out into the world and knocking it out of the park. Men who are not just achieving vocationally, they are overachieving.
Oh, yeah. And the people are cheering you on.
Absolutely.
Straight into flames.
Yes. We don't see the evidence of fear and worry, but here's how I think it shows up. I think those men are medicating with work, sometimes medicating in one of the categories we discussed. Here's how I think it often shows up. I think these men who go out in the community, great leaders, doing great vocationally, who, if they were stuck in traffic or got cut off in traffic, would lose their minds. Like, not a small bit of anger, like full on rage. That's the way I think anxiety and depression can show up on adult males sometimes. So it gets missed. And we'll even say it like, woo, he gets real angry in the wrong moments, but we don't call it what it is. We don't look underneath the anger to see, I wonder what may be there. I think there are a lot of anxious men in the world who are highly controlling. And I think we talk a lot about how with kids, there's always a power and control phenomena in play. The more out of control I feel internally, the more tempted I am to control something externally. So a lot of anxious kids get really rigid. And when plans change, they lose their minds. During transitions, they struggle greatly. And I think that's the adult version. It's like those men often are high, high control and lose their minds when unpredictability comes into the equation. So all of that shared to say, to the great conversation you and I are having around this idea, I think the current stats we have access to are actually not as accurate as the struggle being even greater than I think it actually is for males in this world.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at and thinking about mental health, and I don't even call it mental health, it has so many connotations, but it's just like when thinking about my health as a human and when thinking about my soul, the best thing that I can do for my kids is making sure that my soul is in a good place and that I'm healthy. And then hopefully I won't pass down some of those things. I'll model that health that hopefully stops some of those. Sometimes those things are generational and you see it.
Yes.
And you're just like, okay, that's a really interesting phenomenon that now I notice, like, my dad did that too. And that's a, you know, there's a big piece, and you're like, I can stop that cycle if I can stop it with myself, and then maybe I won't pass it down. So sometimes it's not like, let's work on these kids. It's like, start with number one. And then that can be the most beautiful gift that you can give your child.
Oh, wholeheartedly agree. Richard Rohr once said, whatever we don't transform, we will transfer. And I think there's so much truth to those words. And we talk a lot about how we can only take the kids we love as far as we've gone ourselves. So to the degree that I struggle with regulation and anger, it's really difficult for me to teach the skills of regulation to the kids that I love. And so we often have that expectation when, to your wise words, the work really does need to start with us. And it's, you know, it's also connected to that great wisdom we all experience every time we board a plane, when flight attendants remind parents on board, like, put your oxygen mask on first. You don't have anything to offer unless you do. And so I think there is so much truth to that. And where we are so often in our practice encouraging parents over and over again to do their own work, even back to anxiety, I've over the years had hundreds of parents say to me, what's the single best thing I can do to support my kids who struggle with being anxious or worried? And I've long said, we'll always say, do your own worry work. Like, it's the best gift you can give the kids you love, because anxiety is contagious, but calm is contagious as well. And so to the degree that I'm doing my own work, I have more calm to offer those moments. To the degree that I'm practicing the work of regulation, I can move myself from stressed to settled, so I can then help the kids I love get from stressed to settled as well.
That's a great word. So I want to rewind a little bit, because I want to go a little deeper for myself. And then for the schools, we move forward in this concept of strong. Talk to me a little bit more about that. I liked where you were going there. I've read some of the book, and just give us a little bit more in this emotional strength, just strength in general. Tell me your thoughts on that.
You know, in the book, I teach what I call the three R's, and the three R's are recognize, regulate, and repair. And my great hope for all kids would be that we are practicing those three R's as a family together over and over and over. And the first R of recognize is that naming. How can I just name more of my experience? How can I pay attention to the signs and signals my body is giving me when I feel stress, when I feel worry, when I feel frustrated? And the second R of regulate is that navigate piece. Like, What healthy coping skills am I employing in these moments to get from stressed to settled? You know, do I really know how to do some deep breathing? And have I practiced that consistently? Because research would tell us it takes at least 30 days to develop new neural pathways. You know, we know a lot about the architecture of the brain right now that we just didn't know 50 years ago. And we know that whatever direction I wire and fire in repeatedly, those become familiar neural pathways. I tend to say to parents, it's kind of like if you've ever been exhausted and you drive the same route home from work to home all the time, every one of us has had a day where we pulled into our driveway and thought, oh my goodness, did I stop at the stop sign or did I drive right through it? Like,
right.
It's like our car's just on autopilot. You know, that happens with us neurologically. Like we repeat the same patterns over and over. And it's that thing that I find happens so often in parenting where I'll hear parents say, like, I grew up in a home where my parents did a lot of yelling. I never wanted to be that as a parent. And here I am right there in those same familiar patterns because it can become the wiring and firing that we do repeatedly in dysregulated moments. So that's the second R. And the third R is repair, which is to take ownership and do any needed relational work. We are all going to blow it. We're going to blow it as parents and need to apologize to our kids. Our siblings are going to have conflict and they're going to need to work that through. And so that third R is foundational to all interpersonal relationships. And practicing those three is foundational, I believe, to emotional and relational health, to well-being. But I emphasize the word practice because we tend to act like those are instinctive skills that kids should just know. I joked with the parents when I came to talk at the school, you know, let's laugh together about the reality of how often I think in homes kids hear parents say things like, you need to calm down, which is comical to me to think we're yelling the words calm down. And often believing our kids just know how to do that when we haven't taught it. I jokingly said to them, that's like someone yelling at me, you need to play the cello. Play the cello. Like you can scream play the cello at me all day, but if you don't teach me how to hold the cello and what to do with the cello, and then I practice the cello, you can scream it all day long and I don't know what I'm doing. And so we have to teach these skills the same way we teach a new instrument, the same way we teach a sport, the same way we teach riding a bike or swimming in the pool. And then we have to practice those. Swimming is not something I do one time. I took swimming lessons for 5 years and then I did swim team for 7 years. And So it's this sense of it's not a one-time deal. It's ongoing practice for those skills to become instinctive for me.
Yeah. And I think that there's a real deep connection. And I honestly don't separate them very much in my own mind between our health and, like I said, and our faith. I see them as the same, honestly. And when I think about them on my own brain, I'm like, okay, what does God have to say about this? What does God have to say about that emotion? And what's the truth that he's revealed to me? And then also when we talk about our faith and how we're passing that down to our children. And then it's not something that you can just say, like, kids believe in Jesus and have faith in God when things are hard. It's like, when things are hard, what do your kids see you do? Do they see you turn to God? And do they see you stop and pray in the day? You know, you hope your kids catch you reading your Bible. You know, and like those types of things are so critical, and you can't, it's almost impossible to give them if you don't have them.
Yes. Well, and to this concept of emotional strength, you know, part of our very foundation as a practice is that we want kids' faith to inform their feelings. And yes. I would argue that more than any other time in history, I feel like the two are really separate. Like our emotional lives are over here, our spiritual lives are over here, and the two don't intersect. And we want there to be always an intersection. And so Think about the conversation we're sharing about anxiety. I think about the wisdom of Paul's words and take every thought captive. Well, think on that for a minute. That's active. That's not passive. And It doesn't work to just say, stop worrying. You know, I'd love to stop worrying sometimes, but as a parent, we know that's not really possible. I love these beings so much. I'm going to worry in different moments. What does it look like to take that worry captive? What does it look like to stop that thought? We call that process in our work cognitive restructuring. And that sounds a little bit like do the hokey pokey and turn yourself around. But the reality is That's living into the scripture of take every thought captive. I've got to do some active work for that to happen. But the truth of the matter is God has given me the ability to do that. That, back to breathing, something as simple as 1 minute of deep breathing can reset my body, can reset my amygdala, can slow my heart rate down. Like, God has given us that ability that we could control our heart rate through something as simple as breathing. That's extraordinary. And that's a practical tool at the intersection of faith and feelings.
Yeah. And there's a, sometimes we can not integrate those two things in the other direction. And we can say, well, just pray about it. And not that prayer is an incredible thing. It's the most powerful thing that we do. So I don't want to undermine the power of prayer in that. But God also gives us tools that we need to use, and gave us wisdom and yes. people like yourself and that have written books and says like, hey, you should pray about this. Absolutely. But also I've got some tools for you to put in your tool bag to be able to overcome the world that I've called you to have dominion over. And so I think that that can be sometimes it's a scary thing as believers when we start talking about mental health. And again, that's why I'm always very hesitant to say mental health, because I'm like, when I talk about health and being a whole person and soul work, that biblical part is a critical, deep part of it. And then there's practical application that comes with it.
Indeed. I so agree.
Yeah, one of my first steps into saying like, hey, I've got to do something about, I didn't even know it was mental health, but I was having trouble sleeping. And so I did like a deep dive on like better sleep and really started doing some very practical things that like revolutionized my sleep. And now I'm maniacal about them. And then now as I'm doing more work, spiritual work and work on myself as a person, I'm like, oh, these things are, I didn't know why these things worked. But now I'm starting to understand that whole process, that body, mind, spirit connection, and how all those things work together. It's really important.
I totally agree. And I love that you all are putting so much emphasis on the intersection of those two places. I don't think we can be doing enough of that ourselves. And then again, on behalf of the kids that we love, so they get to grow up sitting front row to see all the evidence of that on the grownups they trust the most in this world.
Yeah, we implemented a school counseling program here at the school a couple of years ago. And it's been really revolutionary, but I think that the philosophy, I didn't know anything about counseling at that time. I was like completely in the dark, but I was like, hey, there's an epidemic, there's a problem going on. We have to do something. We can't just sit on our hands anymore. And so I started doing the work, because what I found is there was kind of two different ends of the spectrum of that counseling world, where one was just like medication practices. And then there was another side that was just like, read this psalm. And I was like, okay, I know that sometimes you need medicine, but not always. And then I know that you always need the psalms. They're important, but sometimes you have a chemical imbalance. And like, that's a medical issue. And so finding that place and working with our staff and talking to our, and I would say kind of where Providence fell was like, if there's this side, which is all medicine, and this side is, we're like, over here-ish. It's like, we're like, hey, mostly it's spiritual foundational things. Mostly it's knowing what God's truth is so you don't believe lies. Mostly it's hiding God's word in your heart. Mostly it's these things. But you know what? There's some physical, chemical things also that are really helpful. But if you don't have those foundational truths, then it's very hard to identify what's a lie.
Yes.
When we hired our dean of girls, I knew that she was the right one. When interviews, I was like, hey, what's the most important thing you would want to tell like teenage girls right now? And she said, the very most important thing if I only got to tell them one thing, is that their feelings are real. Their feelings are important and have to be dealt with, but they're probably lying to you.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, golly, doc, what a, I was like, you're hired. Like you're the
That's
one.
That's fantastic.
'Cause it's true. That they lie to you, and they're probably yes. not serving you very well. And so, but that doesn't mean you just ignore them.
Yes. Yes.
And that can be, because that can, when you, if you just like stuff it down, if you just tell a kid like stuff it down, it's like, that's going to, if they possibly can do that, it's going to come back to bite them later.
That's why I always go back to name and navigate, name and navigate. Practicing those three R's is what I think allows us to develop those skills.
Absolutely. So in our last like 10 minutes here, let's talk about, and this is what I really appreciated in your training that you did with our teachers. Let's talk about for 10 minutes, it's like some practical things. If you're a parent listening to this podcast and maybe you have a kid that struggles with anxiety or anger or depression, can you give us some of those practical things that you can be like, hey, you can do this stuff right now? And again, you got to have all this foundational biblical truth things. And then there's a lot of stuff that goes around this, but here's some practical stuff. Can you walk us through some of those things?
I'd love to. I would say 101 for me is going to be get a feelings chart and download it. Because I think for so many kids, and I think a lot of adolescents, we ask them with some regularity, you know, they're reporting an event that took place at school or with friends, and we're like, how'd you feel about that? I don't know. Or they struggle to get to an answer. And I love a feelings chart because I think it turns fill in the blank into multiple choice. So all of a sudden, I don't have to come up with whatever that feeling might be, or even to the conversation you and I were sharing where there's something underneath the anger. I think it's a great tool to ask that question. What do you think could have been underneath that? What else might have been in the mix for you? And I think the chart is a useful tool for families. I think it also is a reminder for us as parents, as you know, we're sitting around the dinner table together as families and talking about our day. What was your high point? What was your low point? Seeing that, I think it serves as a visual cue to remind us as parents, I need to be folding more of that in. I need to make sure my kids hear me saying things like, you know what? I had to give a presentation to the board of directors today, and I felt embarrassed. I didn't feel as prepared as I wanted to. Or I think I said something that hurt a friend or a coworker's feelings. I feel sad or I feel worried about that. I want to circle back and check in with them. So that modeling is another part of what I think we're reminded to do when we have that visual cue of the feelings chart.
Yeah, that's huge. I have one, right? I was going to try to reach out. I have one behind my desk because sometimes even for a middle school boy, you ask him like, hey, why'd you do that? And then they're always, their response is, I don't know. And so if you can give them something to be like, hey, when you did that, what were you feeling? What was going through your mind? Let's talk. And then give them some vocab is so key to help them name that.
I agree.
I remember when my coach, he first gave it to me. He was like, Ben, you're going to hate this. And I was like, all right, I'm ready. And it was like this rainbow chart called the feelings wheel. And he was like, you're going to have to find your spot on that a few times a day. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is ridiculous. But I was like so committed to not just like derailing my family and my faith and everything around me. I was like, I will do anything. I will do something as ridiculous as the feelings wheel because this is so important. But I found being able to put some vocab to some of those things allowed me to kind of figure out where I was and why I was doing some of the things that I was doing. And I thought that was a really powerful tool. And it could be really powerful for middle school boys to be able to say like, I was feeling overwhelmed or I was feeling frustrated because no one heard me. And like people didn't understand what I was trying to say and they were misinterpreting it. And so when they misinterpreted me, I was betrayed. And it's like, dang, you just said the word betrayed. Yes. And you're like 13. And it's like, yeah, man, I felt betrayed. It's like, whoa. Well, that would explain why you threw an orange at them. Like, now we know why. Now we got to do something with it. It doesn't mean just because you were feeling betrayed doesn't mean your actions are okay. That's not permissive. Your feelings don't get to augment reality and make things permissive. But like, at least now we know.
Yes. Well, and I think about the wisdom of those words. You know, if you can name it, you can tame it. To your great question of why, I can't change the outcome. I can't change my behavior well unless I can first name it. I can't tame anything that I can't first name. And so I think that's foundational. And I think the feelings chart is so helpful. I also, am always, back to the breathing thing, going to want to be coaching kids in what we call square breathing, or I often with boys call it combat breathing, which is something I learned from some consulting I did with Navy SEALs and Army Rangers. It's a required skill for them because, you know, I love when you talked about the lizard brain on the front side of our conversation. You know, we all have one. And when my thinking brain goes offline, my lizard brain takes over in those moments. What do I need to do to get my thinking brain back online? Because if it's not, I can't manage my emotions. I cannot think rationally. And research would tell us at least 20 seconds of deep breathing will begin to reset the amygdala. It'll get us out of that fight, flight, or freeze part of our brain into some rational thinking. If we double that to 40 seconds, twice the benefit, triple it to 60, 1 minute, just 1 minute of deep breathing. I wear an Apple Watch, and I will often, when I'm teaching it to kids, have them look at my heart rate on my home screen. And I'll say, do you think my heart rate's going to go up or down? And kids always know, and they get to see it. The physical impact of a minute of deep breathing, I can lower my heart rate at least 1 to 2 points, if not more. And so that, again, ability marrying the two to see God made my body in a way that if I just slow my breathing down a few times a day and slow my heart rate down, I can get to more rational thinking. So I'm always going to want to start kids in that space. Another is one we call grounding games, and we find this to be highly effective for kids who struggle with anxiety in particular. Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, is considered to be the gold standard for treating anxiety. And so grounding techniques, we call them grounding games with kids, are what we want to equip them with. So in those moments where my brain is racing all over the place, thinking through worst case scenarios, how can I ground myself in the present? Because anxiety always resides in the past or the future. I'm worried about something that did happen and might happen again, or something that could happen. Yeah. And so grounding games help me get into the present. And we can do that. One we teach kids is one we call the counting game. So we'd make this harder or easier depending on how good they are at math. If they're new at math, I might say, okay, let's count backwards from 50 by fives, 50, 45, 40, 35. If they're really good, I'm going to say backwards from 100 by 7, 100, 93, 86. That's as far as I can go without really thinking. And yes. Think on that. I cannot devote myself to this good cognitive work and also be fully devoted to anxiety. It's not biologically possible. And so if I'm engaged in these grounding games, I'm rooting myself in the present in a way that I can get out of that past or future thinking. So those are a handful I would throw out as kind of starting points for any family thinking about how could I begin equipping the kids I love in these ways.
Oh, that's great. All right, last question. What's like the top challenge you see facing families today? And kind of what's your perspective?
I'm tempted to say technology. I think that's low-hanging fruit, and I do believe strongly it's a barrier to families connecting. I think it's a barrier to regulation. I think it's a barrier to so many things. But I would go beyond that, and I think technology is within my answer that I'd give, to say I think it is the intentionality of time, how we spend our time. And I hear that from parents consistently, you know, that we're living in this moment in time where our kids have access to more enrichment and extracurricular opportunities, amazing opportunities, than any other time in history. And we are convinced that flooding them with those opportunities is what yields great adults. And we've even built a college system around that belief in some ways. Like, you got a crazy, insane, impressive resume by the time you're a senior in high school in order to get in. And I am concerned that too, to our conversation about anxiety, is a key contributing factor. We know that overscheduling is a key factor in anxiety. And the pressure I think kids and parents heap on themselves to maintain a pace that A, is not sustainable long term, B, does yield more anxiety and overscheduling, and B, back to our faith informing everything, I'm not sure is leaving us aligned with who we want to be as the people of God in this world. And so I think there is something so wise about really wrestling through how we spend our time, what we commit our time to, so that we make sure our time is aligned with who we want to be as people of faith, and that we aren't inviting more anxiety instead of less because of things like overscheduling.
Man, that is great advice. I can't thank you enough for your time. We have all of your books in our Spirit store. So parents, if you want to check those out, you can read those. They're available as a resource to our parents. And they're also in our library. So if you don't want to buy them, they can just check them out as well. But we want to make sure that, I would say, strong schools are built on strong families. And so the stronger that our families can be, the better. And we want to put resources in front of our parents for that. And thank you for your time and your devotion to helping kids and helping families. And I can't wait to keep you up to date as our Strong Child Project moves forward. Mm-hmm. And we utilize some of the tools and tips and things that you have been cultivating and developing. And we just appreciate you and your time.
Well, it's an honor to partner with you. I meant what I said on the front side of our conversation. I love being in your community. I love that we could pick the conversation back up today, and just grateful for how committed you are to kids and families. You are absolutely building strong families. I sat front row to all the evidence of that when I was there. So thanks for the great life-giving work you're doing.
My pleasure. Have a fantastic day. And if you ever need anything, just reach out to Providence Academy. We're here for you. Mm-hmm.